welcome to a very special edition of You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia, and this week only live from the floor of the Philadelphia Flower Show. Okay, so the Flower Show was in March, and it's April now, but we were able to tape my talk at the Flower Show and get it together for a special edition of You Bet Your Garden. So without further ado, here we go. Let's pick me up on the Flower Show floor.
I have a miniature apple tree that never produces apples. It's probably about 10 years old. Now, there is another apple tree in the neighbor's yard, which I thought would cross-pollinate it, but it never does.
Okay. Do they bloom at the same time?
Yes.
The questions get much harder after this.
Yes. Okay. Yeah, I think it does. And I didn't realize when I planted it, I should have planted two.
Do you prune it?
Somewhat. Not
when?
As much as I should. In the autumn time.
Okay. You're the cause.
Okay.
Anything that flowers in the spring, and it turns out that this is probably one of the most common actual mistakes gardeners make. And it is because you're bored. You realize winter's coming. It's fall. There's nice days still, but soon you're going to be stuck looking at your spouse and your wallpaper for much too long again. And you look out at your landscape, and some garden writer somewhere is going to have an article, "Time to Clean Up the Garden." Well, it's time to clean up that garden writer, because there is a simple little memory game you can play about fall pruning. Tells you which plants you can prune in the fall. None of them. You're bored. Watch the World Series. Watch exhibition football. Go on a vacation. Go down the shore. In September, the places are cheap and the water is finally warm. Leave your bad plants alone. The best gardening advice I can give people is after you're done pruning everything in the spring, put your pruners in a box, send it to someone you may know in Australia, and tell them to send it back when it'll get to you in January, when I trust that you'll be safe, unless it's a warm day in January and you're bored again. Apples, cherries, rhododendrons, azaleas, lilacs, all these plants that bloom in the spring, they have set all their flower buds for the following year by mid-June, latest at the 1st of July. So the only time it's safe to prune a spring-blooming plant is after it blooms. Now, people who have very productive apple trees, big trees that produce lots, they will often prune in the wintertime to remove straight-up branches that are not going to produce fruit and crossing branches. But they have so many apples coming in that they don't know what to do with them. In your case, the pruning advice would be after the flowers go, then you can go out and prune off any branches that are sticking straight up and any crossing branches. Or, since you do get flowers, if you want to be adventurous, you could have sex with your tree. You say it's a dwarf apple tree, so go out there with an artist paintbrush and transfer pollen from one flower to the other. Now, bees should be doing this like crazy. You should see bees all over your trees. And obviously, if it flowers, it gets enough sun.
Right.
So I would suggest you stop pruning it. Don't feed it any kind of chemical fertilizer. Don't put any kind of wood mulch around it. And if you wanted to do something productive, even though it doesn't seem immediately intuitive, plant small flowers around the base of the tree to attract more pollinators. If you've got a lot of flowers, you should be getting a lot of apples.
Right. Okay, thank you.
All right.
Okay, we'll go over here, second row.
I don't even choose. This is great.
Is there any hope for our hydrangeas that have started?
I think I saw a hand up over here, though. How many years did we get great blooms on our hydrangeas? We never had to worry about them. And then the last couple of winters, we've had one of two things happen. I think it was 3 years ago, We just had the winter from hell and everything died. Then last year, we did not get a late freeze. We had freezing cold temperatures exactly when we were still supposed to have them. But the winter had been so warm that the trees were already in flower. So those flowers froze and didn't have a chance to become fruits. Same thing happened to hydrangeas last year. So they were already growing, and then their flower buds, whether they looked like flower buds or not, were frosted out by that cold snap. Now, my hydrangeas did indeed bloom, but not well, and very late in the season this past spring. And this is where the expression lose the farm comes from. I mean, gardening is a crapshoot. If you want guaranteed success every year, take up woodworking, something you can control. One thing I can tell you to try to protect your hydrangeas is not to prune them almost at all. Hydrangeas can be severely damaged if you cut them back in the fall. I know a lot of people will tell you to. But another reason not to prune anything in the fall, no matter when it blooms. Let's say we have a winter event like we did yesterday, and the event is so severe that it winter kills the top, say, 18 inches of things like rose bushes or hydrangeas. Well, if you left them alone at the fall, you probably have 2-3 feet below that. But if you got really clever and you wanted to have a really tidy Martha Stewart garden over the winter, and you cut those plants back to 18 inches high, well, guess what? You just rolled the dice and lost badly. Leaving the plant fully intact over winter may often not look the best. Hydrangeas and lilacs are not four-season plants. You know, when they're not in bloom, they're not the best-looking plants in the showcase. But when you leave things alone in the fall, two things happen. First, you have this biomass that the plant itself can then better survive a chilling cold. Also, the more biomass, plant matter you have on top, the more the crown, the underground part of the plant that we rely on, is insulated. First, by just having this material growing on top, and second, all that material can trap snow. Snow is good for plants. Plants love snow. The most dangerous time for our plants is a cold winter without snow. Snow is the perfect insulation. If you were to apply snow as a mulch, you would do it the first time the soil freezes hard. You should never apply mulch in the fall to soil that's still warm. You know, it's not a blankie. It's not an electric blankie. Your 2 inches of chipped up dyed pallets from China is not going to keep the plant warm when it's 20 degrees outside. But what it can do, if the soil is already frozen when you put it down, it can moderate the freezing and thawing that damages plants. Then they won't be subject to warm days and cold nights so much. There'll be an insulating layer. When we have the correct amount of snow on the ground, it's always like 32, 30 degrees right at the root zone of the plant. They love that. But if we cut them back in the fall, we expose them to winter injury. We take away more of the material that can hold snow. In the spring, no matter what, one time I was struggling with my own hydrangeas. I was a beginning gardener, so I felt like I had to take care of plants. So I was out there pruning the heck out of everything, and of course saw very few blooms for it. So I had this opportunity to have a guy on, I think it was from Tyler Arboretum, a renowned pruning expert on hydrangeas. And I said, get him in the studio. I'm so glad to have you here. I don't know a single thing about pruning hydrangeas. And he goes, well, neither do I. I go, what? He goes, well, I've been in this business for 35 years. I have seen hydrangeas that only bloom on old wood. A gardener mowed them to the ground, and they bloom beautifully the next year. I've seen hydrangeas that only bloom on new wood, only bloom on old wood. So I said, well, what do? He said, you do the best thing any gardener can do. You cheat. And that's you leave your hydrangea plants alone until the flowers appear. Now, again, sorry if you didn't get flowers that year. But after the flowers appear, then no matter what you think your hydrangea blooms on, once all the flower heads are set, then you go in with your pruners and you remove entire branches that are not flowering. This will open up the plant to more airflow, and it will make it look like you have more flowers because you're exposing them. You know, the best hydrangea flowers are against the back wall. They're never facing the street. You know, the plants don't want your neighbors to see all your flowers. So after all the blooms are set, then you can go and selectively remove branches. That's the best advice. Otherwise, we're finding that hydrangeas are very much prone to winter injury.
All right, it's time for me to take a little break and announce that I will appear at the Easttown Library in Berwyn, PA on Wednesday, May 3rd at 7 p.m. and at the Green Garden Fair in Cherry Hill, New Jersey on Saturday, May 6th. But don't go looking for all the details at the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with more live Q&A from the floor of the famed Philadelphia Flower Show. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by the Espoma Company, offering a complete selection of natural organic plant foods and potting soils. More information about Espoma and the Espoma Natural Gardening Community can be found at espoma.com. And by Burpee, celebrating their 140th year of providing treasured heirloom varieties, hardworking hybrids, seed starting, garden supplies, and more. Burpee offers no treated seed or genetically modified organisms. Information at burpee.com.
Welcome back to a very special edition of You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia and from the floor of the famed Philadelphia Flower Show. Just a few weeks ago, I gave my annual lecture at the Flower Show, and instead of a regular kind of lecture, it's the same kind of Q&A that I do with you out there, cats and kittens. So without further ado, let's rejoin me and a live crowd on the floor of the Philadelphia Flower Show.
Clara from New Jersey. I have a seedling that I planted 2 years ago, dogwood. It's growing, but I don't know what to do with it at this point, or should I be doing anything?
Well, dogwood wants morning sun and afternoon shade. It also wants an area that's well-drained. It can be a disease-prone plant, but when we have disease-prone plants, we plant them where they get morning sun. That dries off the leaves. I mean, this is any plant that is disease-prone, roses, tomatoes, God help us, lilacs. These are plants that want to get the morning sun. In your vegetable garden, pepper plants, as long as they get 6 to 8 hours of sun a day, they don't care when they get it. Tomato plants need those first rays of the morning sun, so do dogwoods. Now, with dogwoods, however, even though they're a blooming plant, they don't like a lot of sun. They are understory plants in the wild. The ideal situation for a dogwood is a place, again, where it gets morning sun, afternoon shade. Now, this is incredibly useful because she already planted the thing. So other than that, because you started with a very small plant, it will take a couple of years to achieve any kind of size. You should not give it any kind of plant food, no chemical spikes or anything like that, no mulch, but a yearly application of compost around the base will not only give it the nutrients it needs, it'll create a little barrier against disease down there.
Any pruning or trimming or just...
What is it with pruning? You are all so bored. Grow more houseplants or something.
I do that.
What have the plants done to us? I mean, anybody here ever see the movies Day of the Triffids or read the books? The Triffids are getting revenge for all the nasty pruning we've done on their plant brethren over the years. All right, pick me out somebody else. You know, before you get started, I want to rant a little more. Anytime you go out to the garden with pruners in your hand, I want you to stop and ask yourself, do I know what I'm doing? You will have immediately a garden that's 50% better. I'm sorry.
No, it's fine. I have a lot of English ivy in my yard, and so what I tend to do is dig these big holes in between it and have a pickaxe to get all the roots out, and I plant plants in the middle of it.
Okay.
And they don't do so well a lot of times, so I'm wondering, does it have a toxin that affects the plants?
English ivy as a ground cover. Now, there is an organization called the Ivy Society that I've had on the show a couple of times. They claim that English ivy is well-behaved and that you have something called Irish ivy. And in your case, it is exactly like the criminal behavior of all my ancestors. It's simply lying in wait for your other plants, and when you turn your back, it will club them, take money from them, and leave them in the street. Two things are happening with a ground cover, and I presume you got the one that is crawling very invasively, very quickly. It doesn't need toxins. It's just big enough. It's George Foreman. It doesn't need to be toxic. It's just hitting you with a hand the size of a polar bear's paw. So it's taking all the nutrients out of the surrounding area. It's also making it impossible for your plants to grow and spread. Now, again, what do we do in a situation like this? We cheat. What you should do is get nice big containers with good drainage. Get your pickaxe, dig a hole big enough to accommodate the container, and then you have two choices. I would urge you to have the lip above, because the ivy's going to come over and steal the lunch money otherwise. But now this might even be a design, right? You have this ivy, and then you got a pot that's like, here's the ivy, and you got a pot coming up here, and you put some nasturtiums or something that trails in the pot going down the side. And instead of a garden problem, now you look like a genius. Now all of a sudden you see these half-submerged pots in gardening magazines in neighbors' yards. There's no plant that is going to do well in a patch of ivy. Ivy's job is to kill other plants. Somebody who lived in my house before me, we're going back to the 80s, I found all these shards of houseplants. They just threw them into a portion of the woods. This one, I'm sure it was a tiny little, desperately not getting along well, not thriving ivy. Well, it has taken over its portion of the woods. And I attack it every year. And it enjoys the exercise. But I think, and I don't know that I've ever even suggested this, but I'm mentally imaging your property. I like the idea of sinking big containers in the ground. Make sure they have good drainage holes in the bottom. The ivy's not going to come up if you've got a good enough lip, say 2 feet high or something like that. You could even cut the bottoms out of the containers to make sure that they drained well. And then plant anything in it you like.
Thank you.
Oh, my God, I came up with something new. Well, even my broken watch is right twice a day, right? Yes, sir.
So, two questions. As you said, the winter 2 years ago was very severe. My hollies died back severely. They are not coming back.
Really?
Really. And the deer ate them, too. They dried out the winter dry. And the second question is, I have like 8 ash trees. Should I treat them or just wait till the boar gets them?
Okay. The holly. I'm surprised to hear that your hollies were damaged by the winter. I have a blue holly that was given to me as a test plant many years ago. And the winter you're describing, it did indeed seem to disappear. And when the winter finally melted, I had a prostrate holly. I mean, a plant that had been 4 or 5 foot tall was now about the height of her ivy. So I didn't think anything was going to come of it. It struggled upright over the course of the summer. I did some support work, got it growing upright again. The top really has never filled in to my satisfaction. But again, I had a guy on the show from one of our local arboretums who is a real holly expert. And he surprised me by saying that if your holly just gets so ragged you can't prune it correctly, or if you keep taking cuttings at Christmas time and ruining the shape, hollies can be cut back dramatically and will regrow from a stump. So I have not done this yet. And he said at the arboretum, I think it was the Scott Arboretum, you know, they don't look good for the first couple of years. You don't do this with a specimen plant. But he said they have regenerated hollies that were thought to be dead by cutting them back, letting them regrow. And after 4 or 5 years, you tend to get a darn nice plant. So the plant I'm talking about at my house is like 4 or 5 feet tall. I keep trying to prune the top into some shape that looks like a plant, and it keeps resisting me. But down at the bottom, there is a new branch coming up that has spectacular growth on it that is a wonderful piece of work. If your plant is really most sincerely dead, however, you dig it up and you plant something else there. It's very unusual, as you know, for deer to eat holly. You either have a lot of deer or they had finished eating the siding off the, you know, off your car and your house. Again, you don't get into gardening for permanence. And that's why, you know, when people email me or call in and they say they want to plant something in memory of someone who's just passed away, and I say, oh, can we do a bench instead? Because you're going to feel so bad if that plant doesn't thrive. In farming, for instance, a success rate of 55% is a wild success. Farmers don't expect to get 100% out of their crop. If they get better than half, they had a great year, and they have to budget it that way. So I think we have to be realistic as gardeners and know we're always going to be losing plants. I mean, if you love animals, if you love dogs, you know you're going to burn through them, and it's going to be heartbreaking every time. Get it out of the ground, get the roots out, make sure the area drains well, and plant something new there, and perhaps not a holly. As to the ash trees, the emerald ash borer is definitely still a threat. There are beneficial insects that have been released that are attacking the borer. Now, trying to remember, is it Bartlett? Yes, I spoke at a Bartlett tree symposium here at the flower show, actually, I think a couple of years ago. They actually put me on as an expert. I fooled them. We talked a lot that day about the emerald ash borer, and since then, I've learned a lot more as well. There is a treatment. It is a chemical. It gets injected under the bark. That's up to you. It's not like you're spraying chemicals all throughout your yard. Hopefully, it would be very specific and be protective. What are the odds that the borer will be controlled before they get to your trees? Probably around 50-50. Again, there's these are all judgment calls. You know, people ask me, they're re-landscaping their house. They ask me what to plant outside. I said, should I name your children as well? I mean, you know, sometimes we have to make these decisions. Now, there is an interesting option. If you go to, and I'm so glad this popped into my feeble little brain. Anything we don't cover here today, anything you want to look up in more depth, go to the show's website. Go to youbetyourgarden.org. Right at the top of the page is Garden Answers A to Z. Look under E for emerald ash borer, A for ash. I do describe a different technique using a new product called BTG. Not the original BT that works against caterpillars, not the BTI that is used against mosquitoes, but Bacillus thuringiensis galleria. That makes me sound smart. This only affects beetles who chew on the leaves. Oddly enough, the emerald ash borer doesn't start out attacking the trunk of the tree. It starts up in the canopy. So if you can get BTG up in the canopy of the tree, you stop the beetles before they can lay the eggs that infest the trees. So there are alternatives out there, but it's a very complex problem.
Hi. I have really low bush roses that bloom through October. I got your message about not pruning, but what about deadheading? Because every...
Roses.
Really low bush...
Okay. The deadheading is not pruning. Deadheading is always advisable. Anytime a flower is faded, absolutely pull it off. For a couple of reasons. If the plant, like roses, are capable of continually blooming throughout the year, removing the dead flower, and you can use a pruner, but just take off right below the hip. Don't start going nuts. Don't start actually pruning. But removing that dead flower actually will stimulate the production of new flowers. The corollary, which is also in your favor, is if there are a lot of dead flowers on a plant, first of all, it looks like Hades, but second, the plant now feels it's done its job. It's produced enough flowers, it's had enough pollination, it can be done for the year. If the plant does not sense that there's all this dead flower material, it's going to be more inclined to keep pumping out flowers. Now, roses. Roses are one of the most important plants not to prune in the fall, because roses are very prone to winter injury. And again, yours are already low growing, so they need all the biomass they can get. So even though you're desperate to do something, you've got the pruners in your hand, leave the roses alone. They need all of their biomass to survive winter. But because they are summer blooming plants, you do get to prune them. And what you do is you wait for spring, when the weather gets nice, and then you watch when the plant starts to grow. And then you mark that on your calendar. 2 or 3 weeks after that, after the new green growth has appeared, then it's totally safe and even advisable to go out and remove entire branches that are crowded, going in the wrong direction, preventing airflow from getting to the inside of the plant. That will not limit the coming summer's flowers. In fact, it'll improve the flowering. One thing that I didn't mention before about fall pruning, every European gardener, every gardener in the UK knows that the proper use of pruning is to make a plant larger, not smaller. Pruning stimulates growth, because when you remove, whether it's you or a deer, the plant knows it just lost a limb. I better grow more limbs, or that deer or gardener may come back for me. So pruning sends a signal to the plant to regrow. As you can imagine, if you're really clever and you're stimulating your plants to regrow in October, you're sucking energy out of the root system that they would have used to survive winter, which they will not now. And you also have all this tender, lush green growth, you know, and you know your luck. It's going to drop down to 20 that night. That fresh sap is going to freeze. Sometimes you even see plant branches that have burst open, that the sap has just broken through the outer layer of the plant. But it's very safe to prune about 2 to 3 weeks after new growth in the spring. Same is true of butterfly bush and other plants that are summer bloomers. The time to prune them is about 3 weeks after growth begins. Spring blooming plants, absolutely. Prune them after they're done flowering, and any plant, if you see a dead flower on it, remove it right away. If for no other reason, it's going to make you look like a better gardener to your neighbors, and that's what this is all about.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce that I will present a Titanic talk on tomatoes on Saturday, May 13th, during the big annual plant sale at the Seed Farm in Emmaus, PA, in the Lehigh Valley. And then I'll return to the Allentown Library for an appearance on Wednesday, May 24th at 7 p.m. But don't go looking for all the details at the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with more live Q&A from the floor of the famed Philadelphia Flower Show. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to a very special You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by the Espoma Company, offering a complete selection of natural organic plant foods and potting soils. More information about Espoma and the Espoma Natural Gardening Community can be found at espoma.com. And by Burpee, celebrating their 140th year of providing treasured heirloom varieties, hardworking hybrids, seed starting, garden supplies, and more. Burpee offers no treated seed or genetically modified organisms. Information at burpee.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia, and this time out only, the floor of the famed Philadelphia Flower Show. Yes, we were able to tape my Q&A with a lively audience of almost 400 people and bring you the best of it in this special show. We're going to return to that lively Q&A right now, and then what are we going to do for a question of the week? You won't want to miss it, and you won't. It's coming up real soon.
Hi.
Hi.
I have a rooftop container garden here in the city,
right.
And I'm starting peppers and tomatoes inside from seed.
Okay.
And I just wondered if you had any tips. The rooftop gets very, very hot in the summer. Some of my tomatoes last year started to do well, but then really kind of failed.
It's one of the problems that people don't understand. Full sun actually means lots of sun until around 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and then I sure wouldn't mind some shade in July and August. So in terms of your rooftop garden, the roofs absorb heat. Is it sitting on blacktop? Do you have decking up there?
It's kind of a
Are the plants going to come down into your living room soon?
It's a white plastic. And there really isn't any shade.
Oh, man, yeah. Yeah, so that's burning them up. And you have easy access to the roof? You're not...
Yes.
How?
It's just stairs up, and you can walk right out.
Okay. What I would suggest is you look at some way to rig up a shade cloth. It's not that expensive. You're running tubing, and then you have this material that you can get at any garden center. You see it at every garden center. They all have shade cloth to use in the summertime. It's not even something you'd have to use all the time. But when it's been 98 degrees every day, you will find that you can cheat. Again, we're back to the magic word. And you can, by using that shade cloth to cool off the sun, you can get your tomatoes to keep pollinating. When my tomatoes out in the open, with no shade cloth, but not as an extreme situation, their pollen might fry because I don't have a shade cloth rigged up over them. You know, in a cloudy, cool summer, you simply don't use it. But in a really hot summer, your plants need some relief in the afternoon. Now, have you ever started seeds before?
Not really, not seriously.
Okay, so one thing I always like to tell people starting seeds for the first time is this is not going to be your year of success. This is going to be a learning experience. Gardeners don't learn from success. A gardener who has no problems throughout their entire life dies as ignorant as they were born. Gardeners like me are super intelligent. I have failed more ways than I could possibly ever imagine. And many of them were at seed starting. You need to use the same six packs that garden centers use. Otherwise, they would use old egg cartons. This isn't a kindergarten class. You're trying for success. So you want to use the same kind of plastic six packs or a similar well-draining, rigid container. It's deep enough. You want to use a seed starting mix. That's a soil-free mix. And none of this junk with the creepy water-holding crystals or chemical fertilizer in it. It gets harder and harder with Miracle-Gro and Osmocote taking over the world. But if you go to a good independent garden center, you can find a good soil-free mix. Or, if they're a true nursery, buy some of theirs, because they buy it by the ton to start their seeds in. Don't use any garden soil or anything like that. Put the containers with the seed starting mix, no seeds yet, in water. Now, the seed starting mix should be so light the containers should be floating. So you want to put it like a brick on top to hold them down into a couple of inches of water till they get really saturated. And then take them out and put them in something like a baking pan, something that has a lip on it that'll hold water in the bottom. And then you put two seeds in each container. Why do we saturate the water first? All you have to do is do it the other way once and watch your seeds go flying all over into the corners to know why. Once the mix is saturated, the seeds are going to stay where you put them. Two seeds in each container because one of them could be a dud. Then you cover them with a little more mix, you pull plastic wrap over top, and you keep them in a reasonably warm area. Now, if you're going to be doing this all the time, you buy a heating mat. Heating mat is something you're going to be using for like 10 days every year. So you have to have a place to keep it for the rest of the time. Because you don't use the heating mat other than to germinate the seeds. But seeds, like tomatoes and peppers, they're going to germinate best at a soil temperature of like 75 degrees. So if your house is reasonably warm, just leave them out in the open somewhere. As soon as the first sprouts are up, you get the wrap off and you turn the heating mats off. Because once the first sprouts are up, the rest of them are almost there. And if you leave the wrap on or the heat underneath, you're going to cook them. Then they need bright light. And this is where most people fall down. Shop lights. 4-foot-long fluorescent tubes are perfect. As the plants get taller, you need to move the lights up on chains, or you start out with the plants on boards or bricks or books, and then selectively take things away. The light is the most important part. You can't stint on it. And if you get to the beginning of the season, and they're tall, and they're spindly, and they're weak, don't be ashamed of going out and buying replacement plants. You had to go through this at least once to know, yes, that was too far away, or he was right about the garden soil or something like that. And if you actually have good success, when the plants are at about 3 weeks of age, if you do have two plants in each cell, you clip off the weakest one. The weakest one will be the one that's probably the tallest or doesn't look good. And yes, you have to do this. You can't grow Siamese twins. I've tried. It doesn't work. And you have to snip it off. You pull it out, you'll kill the other plant as well. And then when they get to be about 4 weeks of age, you give them a little feeding with compost tea or a nice organic fertilizer, because they're going to be in your house. You can't use a fish and seaweed mix. But look for something else, a little bit of kelp, worm castings on the surface. Bagged worm castings are readily available everywhere now. They work great.
Okay, I think we have time for one more question.
One more.
Okay, you want to pick a mic? You want to pick?
No. I don't want to make any enemies. That's why you're here.
On our farm, we have a 40-foot tree, like right in front of the house. It's right. Dead. So It's full sun. What do we plant there? Nothing that's like super huge roots that's going to get into the tree, like into the house?
So the first thing you have to realize is you can't plant anything there until not only the tree is cut down, but the stump is pulled.
Okay.
So because people say, oh, I had two trees taken down. I said, is the stump still in the ground? And they go, well, we had it ground down. And I go, okay, so the stump is in the ground but no longer obvious. What can I plant there? Nothing. It's full. You know, that it's like trying to park a car on top of another one. You know, There's no place for the roots to grow, and it's very expensive. First, have a tree professionally taken down, especially near a house. Word professional comes to mind. And then it costs, again, about as much again to have the stump pulled. And you have to make sure that these roots are nowhere near your foundation, or grabbing onto water pipes or something like that, because you could do a lot of underground damage. So my go-to situation in this is you have a couple of options. First, if you simply have the tree limbed, that is, have all the limbs cut off, and then leave a remaining height that is safe, that'll be your new bird feeder. That tree will be colonized. No, I'm serious. The National Wildlife Federation, all of these conservation groups always recommend that when possible, you leave the snag of a dead tree. It's a tremendous breeding ground for wildlife. If that is not an option, I would suggest having the tree taken down. If you're going to have the stump ground down, or you're going to have a little bit of stump left, two options. So you have a little bit of stump left, you got a perfect place to put big containers out on. You've saved yourself an enormous amount of expense, and then you can use that as a focal point. And, of course, you've also seen trees that have been taken down somewhat, and then someone will carve and stain what's left, and you'll have a structure out there. Now, the roots will make it difficult to impossible to plant in the ground, but you can always do containers around that until the roots are finished. Your other option is to take it down all the way, get it ground, and then box it out. Make a real big raised bed, like 2 feet high, and then in that bed you can plant whatever you want and you didn't have to pull the stump.
All right, as promised, it is time for the question of the week for this special show. Growing a garden in a ground cover. Alexis Landis, producer of You Bet Your Garden and big fan of The Flower Show, please start us off with this week's question.
I'd be happy to. It appears that you were so impressed with one of your made-up on-the-spot answers that you decided to expand on it for this week's special Flower Show Show's Question of the Week.
I've had the honor of speaking at the fabulous Philadelphia Flower Show pretty much every year since sometime back in the early 90s. And thanks to our magnificent friends at the show, we were able to record this year's talk, a lively Q&A with a great crowd of almost 400 people to create this special show.
Oh, kind of like a rock band or singer releasing a live-in-concert album, huh?
Well, nobody wants to hear me sing, but I am the rock star of organic gardening. Anyway, the big question about this show is what to do for a question of the week at the end. But when we reviewed the audio bits to decide which things to choose for the show, one jumped out as the perfect choice.
A young woman who wondered if there was any way she could facilitate some landscape plants into an existing bed of ivy.
Which is absolutely an impossible situation. But then this image popped into my head. Big planters buried like a foot deep into the soil right in the middle of the ivy. Now I'm hoping this is an original idea, because if it is, it's one of my best.
Yes, I love the image. But how are we controlling the ivy?
Ivy cannot be controlled, only managed. Now, let's drop back. I'm thinking big, durable containers. Certainly not terracotta or any kind of ceramic, as the containers are going to need to safely survive the winter. Heavy plastic, at least. Although the half whiskey barrels you see at garden centers would be perfect for this.
And the bigger the container, the better the chance that perennials or cold hardy plants like pansies would survive in them over the winter.
Or salad greens, at least deep into the fall. Or, here's another nice image, spring bulbs. Let's say you install the containers, quote, now, and you grow annuals in them over the summer. If the area is sunny, you could grow some really colorful hot pepper plants in them over the summer.
Which are very ornamental, as are the gourmet neon-colored eggplant varieties.
And herbs, many of which would do well even if this is a much shadier situation, as would true shade-loving bedding flowers like begonias and impatiens. Then, when summer is over, plant cold-weather-loving pansies as soon as they're available. Then, right around Halloween, gently pull out those pansies for a little bit, plant spring bulbs in the containers around 6 inches deep, and then replace the pansies over top of the planted bulbs.
Those pansies are going to keep blooming through most of the winter, maybe all winter if you don't get ice storms. And then I'm guessing that the bulb leaves and stalks would just emerge around and through the pansies, right?
Yeah, and if you plant really early blooming bulbs, you'll have time to let their greenery turn naturally brown before the pansies start to fade in the heat. Then the bulb should bloom again the next year. Or you could just plant cold hardy perennials in the containers that have some sort of four season interest.
Okay, back to the ivy.
Okay, so here's my plan. We use a sharp shovel or something like an ice chopper to sever the ivy and then remove a circle of ivy and soil that's slightly larger than the base of the container. Then dig down around a foot and then use a garden fork to break up the soil in the bottom of the hole.
For good drainage.
Absolutely, and make sure those containers have super good drainage as well. At the flower show, I think I might have even suggested removing the entire bottom of the container if it's appropriate to the material to ensure perfect drainage.
Then the same basic rules as with any container, a mix of about two-thirds of a light, loose, soil-free mix and one-third compost with maybe some added perlite?
Absolutely, I'm a fool for perlite.
But what about the ivy?
Yeah, okay, so if the containers are large enough, and we sink them deep enough, and we do the right prep work up front, the containers should double as edging and keep the ivy on the outside. Then it's the gardener's choice. Weed whack the sides on a monthly basis, prune or edge the ivy at the very bottom of the container on a regular basis, or let the ivy crawl up the sides until it reaches the top, and then prune it before it goes over the lip.
Ivy-covered containers. What a great look.
Right? Now, I'm going to suggest something even wilder. Maybe don't plant anything in the containers. Instead, have some sort of trellis in there. Maybe even something like a big steel model of a structure like the Eiffel Tower. Then let the ivy come all the way up, over, in, and up again to make a living sculpture. It's all one plant, but now it's three-dimensional, not just that flat ground cover surface.
I like all of it. If there's enough room, maybe have some containers with outside plants and a big 3D ivy trellis in the middle.
And if you're working with an easier non-climbing ground cover like Pachysandra, you just sink the containers and plant in them. Either way, it's really going to transform the space. Well, those sure were some great ideas about rising up out of your ground covers now, wasn't they? Luckily for you, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website. To read it over in detail, just click the link for the question of the week at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Gardens Alive supports the You Bet Your Garden question of the week. Yikes, my producer is threatening to drop me into a bed of ivy if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. Sorry we didn't take any of your actual phone calls this time out, but you really can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499. Leave us a message and you may magically appear on the air or the show or, you know, whatever it is. We'll call you back, okay? That's 1-888-346-9499. Or send us your email. You're tired, you're poor, you're wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore at garden@whyy.org. Please include your location. And visit our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where you'll find the answers to all your garden questions, audio of this show, past shows, and our podcast. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer this week is Bob Alls. Our social media director is Amanda McGrath. Check out her fine work at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. Special thanks to all the folks at the 2017 Philadelphia Flower Show who made this live event possible, especially Alan Jaffe, Sam the Sham Lemhenny, Barley Van Cleef, and the Fabulous 400 who turned out for my talk. And very special thanks to IATSE Local 8 for facilitating the taping as well. Larissa Sapko and Rich Banowitz make our website a flower show every day. Our intrepid intern, Michael Inglaze, and production assistant, Brett the Viking Raider, were also there to make this special show possible and to chow down on the free cereal bars that Kind was giving out. Alexis Landis, who produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, she's still steaming that she was unable to find the stand with the free Kind bars. They were really good, too, Alexis. Our editor, Al Banks, somehow supervised the taping of my talk to sound really great, despite the constant high-ceiling echo and occasional lost child announcement. I'm your lost child, Mike McGrath, and I'll find my way back to see you and eat more of them free Kind bars again next week. It's time to stop feeding the birds. I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next You Bet Your Garden, we'll reveal a scheme to get your winged wonders to devour your garden pests instead and raise their young to be self-sustaining.